Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Welcome to Let's Get Busy. I'm Matthew Winner. What is the coolest thing you've ever seen somebody do with a book? Is it a book trailer? Is it a adaptation into a play or a musical? Is it a cool book report that you've seen students do? Is it a way that children have taken that book and made it their own through some fantastic act of play or creativity? What about taking a Newbery Award-winning book and summing it up through film in 90 seconds or less? Today's guest is James Kennedy. Now, James Kennedy is the author of The Order of Odd Fish, and he is also the founder of the 90-second Newbery Film Festival. And if you have not discovered the 92nd Newbery Film Festival yet, you, my friend, are in for a treat. There are hundreds, maybe even thousands at this point, of videos that have been submitted to James for this film festival that he does take on tour around the country. And some of the entries are brilliant. Some are straightforward takes on a summary of the book. Some are cinematic. Some are bizarre adaptations that work incredibly, like telling a story through Minecraft or through the eyes of Star Wars or as a one-man show. It's incredible what people have come up with. And it's even cooler to meet the guy behind it all. This guy, James Kennedy, has got so much energy and enthusiasm and passion, and I'm so glad you get to meet him, and I'm so glad you get to hear about the start of 92nd Newbery and about where it's going, and maybe you'll too be inspired to play and to pay homage to your favorite Newbery books this way. It's episode number 234 of the Let's Get Busy podcast, and I am just so thankful, so grateful to have been surrounded by the people that I have been so far on this podcast. There are changes coming in the future. There's a change in the amount of episodes being released. I'm going to drop down to one episode per week for my own sanity and also to be able to offer even more of myself to you with each episode. We've got great guests coming down the road. Down the road as early as next week. And down the road 6 months in advance. There's so much happening. There's even a big surprise coming that I don't want to tell you about yet. But that I'll make sure I share with you soon. But in the meantime, get excited for this 90-second Newbery. Listen to my chat with James and then hop over to the website, which is linked in the show notes, so that you can discover so much amazingness. So much. All right, everybody, let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, James Kennedy. I am excited to talk to you tonight, buddy.
Excited to talk to you.
And happy post youth media awards season, because this is your time.
You being media awards, what's that?
Well, let me just tell you that it's the time when some people get to get phone calls at god-awful times in the morning, apparently. And then all of us in the library world get to hear stories about how they were ignoring the phone call because they were like, what person would call at this god-awful hour in the morning?
You know what it's really the season of? It's the season of a lot of people trying to rehearse their, this is my, the call story. And they're trying to put themselves in as a whimsical situation as possible. So, I was at dog church when the call came, and like they go, and then kind of wrap it all up with like a little sentimental bow at the end, and they go, geez, God, somebody's got to like make an animation of that. This person's a modern day Lois Lowry. They really nailed it. I'm sure that is going through every hopeful's mind, and even people who are not hopeful, just like, oh, I got the call story.
It would be hilarious to know what, like, not that it's ever, there are some people that were sharing some authors that I feel, quite frankly, I felt a little bad for them, that so many of us are talking about it in like Mock Newberry's and Mock Calicott's, that they were saying like, it's so sweet that all of you have been talking about my book. I don't want it to be in my head. I want to just, you know, good luck to everyone and whatever. But to be a person like that, where people have been talking about your book for a couple months, and then you go to bed the night before and then potentially like can't sleep. I mean, that's gotta be a god awful feeling.
They have the consolation of having them had their books talked about.
That's true. That's a good call. That's a great spin on it. My can't go to sleep thing is always the night before the first day of school for the new school year, and that never turns out to be the same feeling as like winning the Newbery.
I wonder if like people do like the same thing. It's like when you see the Oscars and somebody thinks that they're going to call their name, and they kind of half get out of their seat,
and then
they have to like sit down again, you know. But the camera's on them, and it captures them like half getting out of their seat because they think they got it. I wonder if some people, like, the phone rings in the morning and like, oh, this is it, and it's like, it's telemarketer or something.
Yeah.
So that's why I feel that there should be like cameras on all children's authors during that night, so we can see and then to call random people at various times and then just say, no, it's not you, and to see how the various ones would react. I think that this can't fail.
or the to just interview the spouses to find out, like, imagine waking up and being like, honey, did the phone ring? No, baby, it was just, sorry, I had to get up to use the bathroom or something. Yeah. Like, those horrible stories, like,
I just get this toilet that sounds like a phone ringing.
Or maybe that's what we'll hear from, like, Matt De La Pena this year, that he'll be like, oh yeah, I woke up at like 4 a.m. because I just had like too many glasses of water before I went to bed, and then the phone rang. It was crazy.
He seems to be like a very chill person, the kind of person who, the phone rang and I got it and it was fine. Like, just, I met him once at a party, and he seemed like one of those like preternaturally calm people that like there's a kind of a bulletproof, there's nothing manic about him at all.
I met him at AASL in Columbus, Ohio this year, at a bar that we were just all hanging out at the end of the evening, and he must have been up at there was a dinner or something with a publisher, something like that was going on, and they had just let out and they all came down. And for me, it was not only that way, the way he carries himself, but also that I knew his face instantly and was like, oh man, that's that guy. And more importantly, that's that guy that wrote that book that I really like. Because I think we all talked about Last Stop on Market Street all year long. It's just, it was a great, it was a really strong book. But to get up beside him and to meet him, and one, he's extremely tall. And I'm a tall guy, but
that's what I was going
to
say.
To be near a guy that makes me feel small is like, oh, this is awesome. He's also like, I'm a very lanky boy too. So to be around a guy who's like, Matt's got a really nice build. And so to be around him, I'm like, look at this. I'm like by a good looking guy. This is it was cool. He's a good looking, he's very photogenic. Matt De La Pena.
I think we gotta give it to somebody who's not so good looking. Gotta give it to a tubby, greasy old dude, you know, and just, you know, let the chips fall where they may. I think these tall people they already have everything going for them.
They're already above all of us. Well,
yeah, exactly.
Sorry, James. They're not above me. We're above you. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry. I should say we are already above you. Oh, Lord. So, okay, we got a lot to cover. We got a lot of ground to cover, and we're going to get to you.
Feel free to cut all of that.
Well, it's all good. I love it all. You, we're going to get to, and I brought up a little bit already that you have founded this wonderful film festival, 92nd Newbery, that I've just been aware of on the interwebs, just because it's a thing, and it's amazing, and it's very inspired, and I want to get to that, but I don't want to hop around a lot, because I don't want it to be jarring. So I do want to first say, I do want to first talk about your book, about the Order of Oddfish, and about just you and writing, because I know nothing about you. I'm coming at you from such a weird angle. It's that I'm coming at you from this film thing that you do, which is something that actually you're like this great organizer of a ton of people making films, but I don't know you, James. I want to get to know you.
Okay. So here's me. How do I approach this? So, The Order of Oddfish came out in 2008, I think. And Random House put it out, I think. And I was very happy about it. And I don't think I knew anything about how to promote a book. I don't think, I didn't really know what you're supposed to do. I kind of came from the world, like, from outside the children's book world. So,
what did you do?
I was a computer programmer.
Okay.
And I had lived in Japan for a couple of years, and I lived in Chicago and DC, and I bopped around and I had taught a bit. And I did some interesting things. But then, you meet these people who they're like, oh, they went to, like, what, that's a Vermont, distance learning thing.
Yeah.
In Montpellier, or you learn that there's this whole kind of Borg of the children's literature world that I just didn't even know existed. Like, I flat out, I just said, well, the book will come out and everything will be great. And so after the book came out, and kind of like too late, I started like building a network of people and meeting people and like going to ALA and things like that. And at the same time I started getting realizing this is like a community that it's a very earnest community. It's very susceptible to spectacle, and like there's things that I think the community would appreciate that weren't being done. So for instance, I spoke at ALA like in 2010. And it was my first time ever speaking at ALA. I'd never been to an ALA conference before, and I didn't know what to do. I said, oh, well, they probably just want you to do some kind of like stand-up act or something. And so I was like 8 in the morning, and I've told the story many times before. I'll just tell it one more time. I showed up I was missing a tooth at the time. I showed up kind of dripping wet and like wearing some bizarre clothes, and I was yelling at all the people in YALSA for giving the Newbery to Neil Gaiman and not to me, not even realizing that YALSA doesn't even give the Newbery, the ALSC or whatever. I was screaming at them for giving, like, and I had this whole like elaborate kind of like supernatural kind of set piece that I had thought out, because I had a friend in the audience who was dressed up as Neil Gaiman, who I tackled. And I stole the Newbery away from him. And then I had another friend come in just as the head of the ALA, put us through a series of mental and physical tests to see who really deserved the Newbery. And then the librarians were just like laughing, but like also like, what? And then Betsy Bird was there, and she was taking it.
Oh, good.
And we had kind of met a couple months before that, because she did an interview with me online. And so we did this whole thing, which we did a 50-yard dash around the room and fencing and handsomest face and thumb war, but I lost all of the contests, and so I was sacrificed on an altar to the dark gods of the American Library Association using a knife forged in the very burning of the Library of Alexandria. And then the fake Neil Gaiman wept over my corpse, and I don't even feel like I deserve this Newbery. He led all the librarians chanting, "Give Kennedy the Newbery," until I sprang to my feet and I accepted it. And I thought, oh, this is what you do. And so I met a lot of librarians and like people in the community like through that. And I thought, well, what if, like, and then at the same time, I was getting a lot of, so I realized, like, doing events is, and making up your own events, making up your own spectacles was kind of like, maybe that would, could be my place in this community that I found myself in and I didn't know how to carry myself in. And so at the same time, I was getting a lot of, like, The Order of Oddfish, oh God, it never sold very well. It's a very weird book. A certain kind of really weird kid likes it. Like, I don't blame the publisher. Like, I wouldn't know what to do with it either. But I stand by it and I love it. But, like, it's for, like, there's like 30 kids in a classroom. There's a one kid in the back of the room who reads Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and watches Monty Python and stuff like that. And, like, it's for that kid. And that kid is loves it. And so I was getting all kinds of, like, really great fan art based on the book, like paintings and like dolls, and somebody had baked a cake that was in the shape of a fish vomiting out a building, which is like a scene that happened in the book, and there like costumes and all sculptures, all kinds of stuff. And so I decided to have a Order of Oddfish fan art show in Chicago, and some friends and I rented out a warehouse, and we invited all these people there, and there was this big party in which we invited all the artists who made this art, and they came from like all over the country, and we put it up, and people were dancing and blah blah. We reenacted one of the scenes from the book, which is called the Dome of Doom, and people dressed up as monster gods from my book and met in this kind of dome that we made out of PVC piping, and we had them fight each other. But there's kind of like Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, but it wasn't really fighting. It was kind of more like a like battle dancing. The one rule was that you couldn't touch each other, and whoever won each round went on to the next round. Person who won the whole thing, we put her on an altar and tore out her heart. All these anecdotes end with an altar and somebody being sacrificed. It just
apparently
realized.
So, yeah.
That's how the 92nd February is going to end. So, so then that was like, that's the way you interact with fans. Like, you show that you appreciate them by, you know, taking like this all this random fan art that was kind of coming at me. And making an event out of it that they can come to and do stuff at, and that was a lot of fun. But it was also a lot of work, and it was also like not repeatable. You can't do like a fan art show every year. And so then I was hanging out with my niece and nephew, and just for fun, we made a short movie of A Wrinkle in Time in their backyard. It was the first time I'd ever like used like a modern digital video camera. It was the first time I'd ever used iMovie. We put it together. It was kind of fun. I was like, I bet you can make a lot of these movies. You could, you could have a short Newbery Film Festival.
Yeah.
And so I put it on. I talked to Betsy Bird about it because we had become friends by then. And she said, great. And so the first year we did it in Chicago and New York City and Portland. We got all like the public libraries involved because public libraries always have like big auditoriums that, that you can take advantage of that aren't always being used. And we put it on, and it's ever since then the 92nd Newbery Film Festival has kind of grown and grown into more and more cities. So now it's not only in Chicago, in New York, and Portland, but it's also, well, next to Portland, it's Tacoma. There's also in San Francisco, in Oakland, in Minneapolis, and in San Antonio, and in Rochester, New York, and Philadelphia is a new one this year, and Oakland near San Francisco. Yeah, so that's hold on, I'm looking through the that's it. So yeah, about like 11 screenings around the country, and I think we're gonna add. I'm gonna try to add Boston and Los Angeles and maybe Phoenix, and then I don't know how many more I can take because it kind of devours the first quarter of my year. But it's a lot of fun. I love it. So I guess it started with like the idea of like spectacle,
yeah,
bringing that into like and how that ties into books and fan appreciation of books, and then how can I make something that's repeatable, and then also something that keeps my name alive in the children's literature community between books, because like as you said, like you know me from film festival, you don't know me from my actual book, but it's kept my book in print, I think, and I think it's also the kind of thing that. Like I'm still meeting people and doing things, but like right after The Order of Oddfish came out, I had two kids, and that destroyed my creativity. Like for some reason, just I didn't know it was that whole thing of, you know, the all through the night holding the baby going shh. And I can't totally blame it all on that, but like I wrote a couple books, but like a couple, I just didn't think that they were any good. Like I've just finished one now that I am showing around, but and I have like a bunch of other ones that are like almost done. So I feel better about it now, but I think all that time, all of my creativity in that time kind of went into organizing and not into writing. I think now it's time for me to kind of turn back more towards writing. And now that this thing has some momentum of its own.
Well, I was going to say though, in that time, when you look at that, yes, it was time away from writing, but I think the impact and the influence you made on readers and on the way they interact with what they read was huge. I mean, I look at, I've checked out from Aaron Zenz is one of the other connections that I have to you, right? So from seeing what Aaron was doing way back, whatever that was, like 3 years ago or something when we met, to browsing all the stuff that I could find on your site, to now appreciating the way that people, not only the kids and groups of not only just like families, but also library programs and things like that are making not just a 90-second or, I don't know, 3-minute or less version of the story, but also some of them are putting on such a great spin on them, like doing it in the style of James Bond or in the style of like some old 70s Japanese kung fu, or not Japanese, an old 70s like kung fu movie, things like that is something that, I mean, that's incredible. That's incredible to see that they not only are trying to remake the movie, but also going like, wait, what else can I do? And I almost feel like the more you show what other videos people are making, and the more that this continues, the more people are inspired to look at it and say like, oh wait, I can do it this way. Like let me just bring it back to the recent awards, the Youth Media Awards. The fact that this year a picture book won the Newbery, I think for a lot of writers is going to go, oh wait, that's right. The Newbery goes down to age zero. It's age zero to 18. So like, could be writing. My book could be considered for this. I think it just, when you show someone that it can be done, it's like the same reason why kids obsess over watching playthrough videos of video games online. It's that when you see someone else do it, it sort of gives you permission to try and to try it in a new way. And that's what you're doing, James. That's huge, man. That's a really huge thing.
I think that it's also a way of keeping the film festival fresh. If you just see like somebody just making a summary of a book the same way, it's like there's only so many times you could do The Giver, you know, before it's you know, it gets really stale. But if it's always done like, oh, we're going to do it all in Japanese, or we're going to do it, you know, all in Minecraft, or we're going to do it in the style of Star Wars, it opens up all kinds of things.
Minecraft one is amazing. I have to link like a billion videos on this post, or just link to your like 25 most popular. But that Millions of Cats Minecraft one, I have showed that to students. It is amazing. And even just to show that to them, and to show them that some of these kids, and it's great they see it as a game, but others, like you're saying in your class with the book, that there's like one out of the 30 kids in a class that like got it. Your book, The Order of Oddfish, and they were like, this is the book for me. When you see a video like that, you think of all these kids that play Minecraft, and one of them in that group is going, oh my word, I can use this to tell a story.
Yeah, I find that when I go to schools and like I'm asked, like, could you like talk for half hour about the 90-second Uber and show some movies? I'll show them, they'll get excited about like the Ramona her father does James Bond, or like the Star Wars one. But what really makes the whole class go, oh, is when I show the Minecraft one. It's like, oh, you can do that. Just like you said about like picture book winning the Newbery. Oh yeah, you can do that. And it's about time a picture book won the Newbery again, because it's there was once upon a time, Millions of Cats, picture book, ABC Bunny, picture book.
Yeah, Frog and Toad.
Frog and Toad. Yeah, and so there's no reason why that can't be the case. And it also kind of like undercuts like maybe the self-seriousness of, you know, sometimes there's a kind of a, let's face it, about the Newbery has a kind of stink of worthiness about it. Like this is good for you feeling to it. And I think like some kids, they see that gold medal on the cover, they're repulsed and they don't want to have anything to do with it. And I have to say, in many cases, they're right. There are some real stinkers there, especially some older ones. And I think the Newbery Committee has been making some great choices lately. I've been very like books that kids would actually, you know, want to read and would get excited about. And I know it's all about the most distinguished one, blah 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 blah. But I reserve the right to give that a little bit of side eye because the idea of like an adult saying, "Well, this is simply the most distinguished children's book. It doesn't matter if any child actually likes it," is ludicrous. I'm not saying that they should go to to something that is, you know, like wholly without merit and just happens to be popular.
Right.
But, the feeling of like fun is I think is kind of coming back to it, and I want to kind of emphasize that side of fun.
Yeah.
So for instance, like the Giver, great book, very grim book. And every year I get about the most popular book to do a 90-second Newbery about is The Giver. So if every year I get like 50 Givers.
Whoa.
And if I never see another Giver in 90-second Newbery again, it'll be too soon. But I love it when they put some bizarre spin on it. I'm just trying to like connect the dots of like and come back to and this stitch this up, this whole idea of like putting a different spin on it, making all the difference in the world. Like, I don't know, did you see that one version of The Giver that was done as a one-man show?
Yes, the one-man show, that was amazing.
Yes.
Where he's like, this is red, this is green.
And it also goes to show you don't need to like be like that whipping boy that was of Star Wars. It doesn't have to be like, that was a great one, but it doesn't have to be that elaborate. Like, you can do, that kid is just like hanging out in his room and doing the whole thing on his own. It's really good editing and sound, but it didn't have to have any special technology to pull off the cleverness that he was doing. Speaking of The Giver, I have noticed that, so the reason that book always gets banned is because there's that baby killing scene where the father kills Gabriel. And I've noticed, by and large, kids love to spend like 20 seconds of their allotted 90 seconds on the baby killing scene. The children are like bloodthirsty monsters. And I put together, I reposted it lately, a supercut of from a couple years ago of all of the baby killing scenes from all of the Giver videos that I've gotten. And they're like grisly. Like the kids just really love doing that scene. It's a supercut that I would never show at an actual 90-second Newbery screening because I think it would like disturb some smaller children. And that's why like we got a 90-second Newbery like last year. It was of a Charlotte's Web, and it was done in the style of a horror movie.
Yes, but I saw that. Yeah, yeah.
It was too scary to show. I showed it in Chicago last year, and there were so many complaints. I was like, that was an actual scary movie. You can't. I guess mission accomplished, and I guess I can't show it anywhere else because I don't want people to be alienated by this thing or complain.
Hey, so James, let me ask then. So when people are submitting the videos, because I haven't gone through, I've only gone as sort of a consumer of the videos, as a fan of the videos, and looked at what I can see, what's posted for me to see. When people submit to you, and I know that we've already missed the deadline to submit, right? It was January 10.
Yeah.
But so when people were submitting to you, or they have the whole year now, so they can start doing it for next year.
Exactly.
But when they do that, it's like emailed to you, it's sent through Dropbox or something, and then you select, what does that look like? Because you're saying like in a year you, for example, got like 50 versions of the Giver. How many videos do you get?
Like hundreds. Wow. Not all of them are, like many of them are unlisted or private.
Okay.
But I get a ton because a lot of them are just like for school assignments and they don't want to be public about it. They just want me to react. And then I'll say, oh, this, and I always like say nice things about whatever I get. Like, I'm never saying like, this is terrible. But I always say something nice. And it used to be in the first couple of years, I would put every video I would put on my blog, and I'd say something about it on my blog. And it's gotten, there's too many, and I need to spin off a site of that is just the 90-second Newbery. Just that's all it does. And I have all the movies just warehoused in one place. You can like, you know, search, like, I want to see all the Wrinkles in Time. And
yeah.
Boom, they all come down. I'm working on that right now. but it's slow going because I'm doing it by myself. But putting that aside, so yeah, you make the movie, you upload it to Vimeo or YouTube or whatever. Don't send me the, and this is all.
Don't send you the. It's on there somewhere. Yeah, of course.
And then upload it, and then just send me the link and what your name is and where you're from, and then I'll usually say I usually confirm that I got it as soon as I can, and then like a week or two later I'll come back with some comments. And if it's to be, and if I decide to screen it in the town that's near them, I'll tell them that and invite them to the screening. And all the screenings are free, but I'll just like link them to like where they can get a free reservation. And so that's usually, we've always have like a full house for these things because people get their movies in and they bring their friends and their family. And like, I just did it in San Antonio, and usually I show like 10 movies from around the country that are ringers, and I would show them anywhere because they're that good. And then 10 that are local that kind of put butts in seats. But in San Antonio, what I did last weekend, I just did all Texas videos, and the places like full of like people, and everybody who was there was like somebody who was either like intimately involved in children's literature, or there was somebody who really, they were there to see something that their son or daughter or cousin or friend had done. And so it was a very, you get very receptive crowds. They really want to like the stuff that's there.
Yeah. I can't help but, okay, so I'm having this moment where I'm like in awe of what you're doing, James. And I just want to say like the fact that I know that you're writing, and it's great that you're writing, and that to leave books behind is such a good thing, but to see the legacy that this 92nd Newbery has become already for you, I know you have a great deal of pride in it, and that the kids that are creating stuff, and kids being some very young and some I know are all the way up in high school age and things like that. I think about the way that you're not only influencing for some teachers what a book report might look like in a really important way that way. Like, no, let's interact with medium in a new way, but also for kids to take a book and be able to read it and go like, I don't have to like this book, but I can turn it into a medium that I really like. I can share it in a way that there are those old Newbery books that are terrible. But it's because the time has moved on, but we can see them in a new light through something like this, or maybe even some kids could see it as a challenge. This, how in the world would you adapt this into a movie? I'm going to do it. And then for them to participate every year, and then to, I don't know, potentially go on to be working in film. Like, you're 5 years in, you might start to have stories like that, but I know in, I don't know, 10 more, someone's going to come back and say, yeah, well, you know, back when I was in middle school, I did this video for Newbery, and it sort of set something off for me.
Oh, that would be great. And then they could option Order of Oddfish, and then we'd be, the kids could go to college. That's very nice of you to say. Like, I think that's the best case scenario. I hope that happens. I think also with like old books that maybe don't stand the test of time, you can also use these movies to like savagely critique them. There's a kind of like merciless version of Onion John floating around out there, which is just clear. It's a high school kid who did it. It's just clear he hated the book, and it was almost like making this movie was a kind of revenge. I something like that is like a person after my own heart. I think like what I like about this film festival is that like the spin that you have on it, like that's like how I hope it's remembered and everything like that. And I think like that's me in my best moments, but me in my everyday moments is like a far more like caustic, cynical, like how can I mess with this person? And like, I'm glad that I was able to do something that started out as like, let's kind of make something that kind of like no matter how worthy or somber a book is, it can be satirized, you know, like we can make Leslie and dying in Bridge to Terabithia be hilarious. And like, that's my dark impulse. And then I'm glad that I was able to find some kind of expression that can in the end be interpreted as like, you're helping all these children. I was like, well, that way everybody wins. I can be a terrible person and then something good can happen in the world.
But it's an outlet, right? That's what making art is. And to even show that for kids, that that's what making art is. It's an outlet. It's a voice. It's a voice that you don't always get to have around your peers or in, I don't know, school or in your family, but it's a voice that can be a safe spot, safely expressed through this medium. I think it's good.
You're right.
I like it.
Oh, thank you. I never imagined that. I guess I'm surprised that it took off, you know, and okay. I never imagined that people would think of it as something that was worthwhile. I think from the very beginning, I was very defensive about it, kind of like thinking, people are just going to say this is like a waste of time or blah, 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 blah. Like, what are these stupid movies? So when people actually have a good reaction to it, I'm like, although this is a funny thing. I don't even know if I should say this, but I was like, I'm sinking all this time into like getting this 90-second Newbery thing off the ground, but I know that the ALA really, really guards the IP of like the Newbery medal. You know, like could they just like shut me down for like using the word Newbery in the name of my film festival?
Oh, I wonder.
So I was doing a film festival in a city, and I was talking to somebody who happened to be on that committee, on the ALSC or whatever committee. Mm-hmm. I said, "Look, you see, it's a film festival. It's fun. People come to it. I'm not being awful. It's not obscene or whatever. Do you think I could get some kind of, you know, official kind of, you know, dispensation so that like I just know that you're not going to shut me down a couple years down the line?" And she was like, "Do you really want me to bring this up in a committee meeting?"
Yeah,
and I was like, "That's I get it. I think it's probably gone as far as it can go while still flying under the radar."
It is the ALA. It's not, you know, the Olympics. Good Lord, no one can use the word the Olympics for anything.
Believe me, I once in my foolish youth. And when the film festival was first starting out, I was like making a poster that like had the medal on it.
Uh-huh.
And I got immediately zapped.
Immediately.
That.
Yeah. They've got like, they are putting money in to make sure that that stays their IP. But I think with ALA, not only is there, limited time and resources, but also this is something that you're pointing back to their award, to the selection. Sure. And it's, I think, honoring the works. And yeah, I don't know. I
think so too. Like that's what I would say. That's what I say to myself. I'm glad that like I've been allowed to continue to do it.
Hey, you know, James, there's always that great adage. It's always it's easier to ask for forgiveness than it is for permission.
That's true. That's true.
Sorry, guys. I love you. Yeah. So how long did it take for you to receive, I guess I'm trying to predict with the books that won this year, how long did it take for you to receive a 90-second Newbery for the crossover last year? Or for any, have received one for El Defo, if you have received one for Brown Girl Dreaming, like how fast will the kids now that are participating be responsive to these wins?
A couple months. Nobody really is... Like I always kind of exhort people like, hey, so like at the end of the season when I'm done with the last show and it's like April or whatever, I'll always send out to my mailing list an email say, okay, this season of 90-Second Newbery is over, but get cracking now, you know, on next year's. And I don't get anything until December, which is just in a lot. But although some of them will come like in the fall or occasionally over the summer. And I got some El Defos early on. That's a super popular book. Everybody loves El Defo. Everybody wants to make something of El Defo, which is great. If I got 50 El Defos a year, I would be so much happier than...
I'm even thinking, like, what's going to happen with Roller Girl? That's going to be super fun, too.
Yes, yes. Actually, I happened to be reading that to my daughters when it got the award. Like, it was...
Oh, wow.
To my discredit, I hadn't read anything else that won this year, but I was reading Roller Girl to them. Because, like, my like just the books that I'm reading right now are like the books that they're reading.
Yeah.
They super loved El Defo. They really, like anything by Reyna.
Yeah.
They really like, and they took to Roller Girl, and I would love to, See, I'd like to see how you can do that. I mean, you can do it in like the kind of, I would love to see just, you know, full on, don't put any spin on it, and just like, see some roller derby.
Exactly. Yep.
And but I'd also like to see X-Wings and TIE Fighters. I'd like to see how many different spins can you put on it of like that could be like some kind of thing, like X-Wings and TIE Fighters or zombies, or like I was really wanted to be on this zombie team, or doing it totally in the style of like a 1970s kind of like what is like the Starlight Express or something.
Oh yeah, imagine. Yeah, there's
that surprise that they didn't drop a Starlight Express reference in that novel, because like the one best friend character is really into musicals, and isn't that a Andrew Lloyd Webber musical about roller derbies?
Is it Andrew Lloyd Webber? I don't remember who did it, but yeah, I wonder, Victoria Jameson, if that was something that was like edited out or something that just wasn't part of her.
Maybe it's too on the nose.
Or maybe it's a reference that they didn't know that the kids would get. Who knows? It's a great story though. There were a lot of, I mean, I think about like my brain right now jumps to, and this, I don't know that it would even be appropriate or not, but I talked to Christian on the podcast, right? I talked to Christian Robinson and got to hear that cool story that like, The Last Stop on Market Street basically was a story that he told to Matt, and then Matt wrote it, and then Christian illustrated it. So in like a really weird way, Christian got to illustrate his own memory, right?
Yeah.
In a slight way like that. But Christian also animates and has done gorgeous things for Sesame Street. And it caused me to think in you just talking now about Roller Girl, like I wonder if Christian or someone like that would ever make anything like this, even to spin their own work that way. I don't know.
I would like to say two things to that. Number one, I hope he does, and I've always been waiting for like people who are like bona fide filmmakers to get in on it, you know, who are real animators. And number two, you just proved to me that Matt De La Pena was totally unnecessary to that book.
Oh, stop. Matt De La Pena.
He was just a stenographer. I got the man's a fraud. I don't care how tall you are, De La Pena. Go ahead, come for me. I'll take your Newberry too. I'll take everyone. I'll sit on a whole heap of them.
Oh Lord!
I'll laugh.
I am sure I'm slandering that entire story, and I'm gonna get letters about how I remembered that all wrong. But
I'll devour those letters. I don't care. There's a picture of me and Matt De La Pena and a bunch of people at that party I was talking about, and it looks like Matt is standing on a barrel. he's in the background. He still looks like he's standing on a barrel.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh my word. Our time, I gotta wrap up our time, man. Our time has flown, and I love this chat. I want to talk to you for like many more hours. I'm glad that we're connected.
As soon as I started yelling about standing on a bloody heap of Newberry medals.
No, see, what were we talking about? We were talking about WTF, and we were talking about Nerdist, and that was that moment where I was like, ooh, I could just hit the stop record now. We could fade out on that, and it'd be the greatest thing ever. But,
It would be. I invite you to edit this, edit out most of it.
Maybe I'll make a Supercuts version of this episode, first ever, James. It'll be amazing.
Oh, yeah. Do a 90-second version of it.
Oh, my word. That'd be amazing. Just to honor the whole thing. Yeah. But listen, this has been really amazing. And to hear that you're getting the response that you are 5 years into 90-Second Newberry, you're getting the response that you are is amazing. And I'm excited to hear about how these different events go around the country. And I hope that you have a blast going around the country and sharing these great videos and taking pride in this thing that you have helped to realize.
Actually, there's one more thing.
Please.
Just talk about like the community in general. I think going around the country, this is something that has helped me like meet people in the community and integrate. Like, I feel like I'm more at home in it. Like when I just came back from San Antonio, I co-hosted with Nikki Lofton, and she's a really great and fun author. And when I did it in New York, it was with John Cheska, or I did it in like San Francisco, it was with Catherine Applegate, and I was able to meet all these people all over, and people who I really have no right to meet in my in terms of like my literary standing, but in terms of this, like people like, or Libba Bray also co-hosted with me. People have been like really welcoming of this and really generous with their time. There's no reason why they had to, for free, you know, get up and, you know, act like a jackass with me on stage. And they've been really welcoming and wonderful, and I'm very appreciative of all the authors who have co-hosted with me.
I hope it continues to keep serving the community the way it does, and to keep inspiring children that way, James. Hey, before I let you go, let me talk kickball. Can we talk kickball quick?
Yes.
All right, man. I'm assembling an all-star Kid Lit Dream Team kickball tournament. I want to know what one person alive or past from the Kid Lit world you would want on your team and why.
Okay. The one that I would want on my team, I thought about this, it would be Madeline Lengel. And the reason is because I'm a terrible athlete, like really bad. My father was a huge athlete. He like lettered and all, like in like football and baseball, all these things, and like was varsity golf at Notre Dame, all this stuff. And I just remember him like, you know, screaming at the TV, football, all my childhood. I never had any interest in any sport ever. Not good at them. But I know that Madeline Lengel was even worse. And I was reading listening to Madeline book by Leonard Marcus, and all people kept saying, "Oh, she was so gawky, she was so awkward. Oh, she was very clumsy. Oh, she, not athletic at all." It's like if she was on a team with me, it would make me look good, and I could, you know, people would say, "Oh, well, Kennedy, well, he's not that bad because Lengel really can't hold it together out there." And so, yeah, frail Madeline Lengel, not in her prime. I'm saying like in her 70s, Madeline Lengel on the kickball team with me.
Here's what I love about Madeline Lengel and her being on a kickball team with you. Not only is Wrinkle in Time like my favorite children's book ever, but yes, to hear Madeline Lengel read her own books as she does in all the audiobook versions, yes, makes me feel like she can be complete crap at kickball, but the feistiness in the ferocity in her voice is like enough that it'd be amazing. Bench or whatever, it'd be amazing with her.
Oh, totally. The stentorian croak. Yeah. It's wonderful. I attended her. I became friends with her granddaughter, who is a supporter of the film festival. And I was, I went to Madeline Lengel's like a memorial service at cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York, like a couple years ago. And in the middle of it, they had a recording of Madeline Lengel doing doing one of the readings, but then the recording kind of like it wouldn't work at first, and then they finally got it working towards the end of the service, and like one of the friends or family or somebody who knew her is like, "Oh, trust Madeline, she always finds a way to get the last word," but when her voice came on, I didn't realize how her voice would be. It was like, yeah, it was this kind of like very commanding voice. I was like, yeah, wow, like no wonder she was like so in demand as a public speaker and stuff. She's like amazing. That. And then I went and I listened to Wrinkle in Time on tape, and I would never give that to a child because it's terrifying. It was a dark and stormy night. My niece who played Meg in that Wrinkle in Time 90 Second Newbery video, she had Wrinkle in Time on audiobook growing up, and she never finished it like until years later because she was afraid of it. She was afraid of the voice. So hats off to the voice. I think the voice, that's why I want her on the team, because it would instill fear in the other team. It would be like Apollo Atreides in Dune. You would just go, "Muad'Dib!" And like the whole the big block would just shatter. Yes, that's why.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Yes. Sorry. I went on and on.
No, I love it. I almost wanted to end on the note that like the voice is what could take down Matt De La Pena. The secret to breaking down the Goliath.
Yeah, every time she says something to him, he just gets smaller and smaller, like Frog and Toad in the dream, until like Matt De La Pena himself just winks out of existence. That would be amazing. No, Matt, you're a natural treasure. You're now an officially certified national treasure. Please don't get small until you disappear, Matt De La Pena.
No, we don't want that. We don't want that. I want Matt to actually do all the kicking for me. What do they call that? The pitcher where like I'll run, but you're gonna kick for me.
Oh, the designated kicker.
The designated kicker. Yeah, I'll run. You can kick for me though. It's good as long as I can like, warm up my muscles to start running. I need like to do where my legs spin like in the cartoon style where they spin in the dirt totally. Before I take off. That's me. James, thank you so much again for coming on. This was awesome. It was fantastic. I'm so thankful. Cool. Best of luck with all the new kids you get to meet, and may you have many, many brilliant adaptations of The Giver in your future.
Thank you.
Let's Get Busy is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland, and by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton and The Best Book Ever This Week. Our theme music is by Blue Ducks. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that is a very good thing indeed. Next up on Let's Get Busy, Charisse Harper and Anna Raff share the story behind a big surprise for Little Card. And later in the week, Sarah Varen talks about sweater weather. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's Koko Sleep, and I'll see you there.